Call this meeting of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Members and staff, this is our first remote hearing 2021 legislative session, and I know a first to many of our members of this committee. I want to go over a couple things before we start official business. We are holding this meeting, this remote hearing, pursuant to temporary House Rule 10.01, which allows for committee procedures related to member debate and voting to occur by means of distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means designed to allow legislative operations while preserving the safety of the public, staff, and members. I do want to do a quick review of remote hearing procedure, since this may be new to some folks, and probably we could all need a little bit of a refresher. The default is to keep yourself on mute, so please be mindful of that, and we will, except for when you are speaking, and staff will not take you off of mute, so that will be on you to remember to do that when you are speaking. I don't know if we have anybody, maybe staff can let me know. I think everybody is via Zoom. My preference is that folks will log in via Zoom and not by phone. It's just much easier to know who's actually present and to make sure we've got the right people in the room as far as quorum is concerned. And that is my preference. We will be sending out some temporary rules hopefully very shortly, hopefully by the end of the day. Folks can take a look at those, and we'll go over those more in depth on Thursday. But for now, our usual house rules and Mason's, as well as custom and usage, will govern how we do things today. As far as recognizing people to speak, we ask that you use the raise your hand function. On the bottom of your screen, it is now under reactions. This is Zoom updated things just before the our legislative session started. So just to keep people on their toes, make sure that you are using that raise hand function. If you do have problems with that or for some reason can't figure that out, you can email our committee administrator, Rachel Ghanani, or I'm not sure. I think you may be able to send a message to her. I'm not sure if we've got that available. You do not have to lower your own hand. Staff will do that for you so that we can track who is here. Thank you, everybody, for being patient with us as we figure this out. And we may need to take certain pauses or breaks as we go to make sure that we've got everything working correctly. And just a reminder, we'll be doing procedural motions as far as approval of minutes, technical amendments via voice vote. But we'll use the roll call each vote that's going to refer a bill or which we are actually going to do today on the first day of a committee. And as is always the case, a member of the committee can request a roll call vote. I have been notified that apparently there's some dinging coming from my computer. So hopefully we can fix that. And I've been notified that a quorum is present, so we will get started. We will be taking the roll for attendance, and as this is our first meeting, when Anna calls you on the roll, if you want to introduce yourself and let us know what part of the state you come from, that would be really helpful. All right, Anna, go ahead.
Chair Beckerson. Chair Becker Finn.
Anna, I can't hear you.
Chair Becker Finn.
Yep, Chair Becker Finn present. This is my first time chairing this committee. I represent District 42B. I live in the city of Roseville and represent Ramsey County suburbs. I guess that's all. You'll find out plenty about me as we go on. Go ahead, Anna.
Representative Moeller.
Hi, present. So I'm Representative Kelly Moeller. I represent District 42A, Arden Hills, Moundsview, Shoreview, and a little bit of Spring Lake Park. I'm happy to be here today.
Representative Scott.
Good morning. I'm Peggy Scott. I represent Andover, Northern Coon Rapids, and one precinct in the city of Andover. Looking forward to our committee's work.
Representative Feist.
Good morning, everyone. I represent District 41B, which covers the southern part of New Brighton, St. Anthony, Columbia Heights, and Hilltop. Thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Good morning, Representative Cedric Frazier, District 45A, which covers the city of Crystal, New Hope, and the eastern part of Plymouth. Glad to be here.
Representative Grossel.
Good morning, everyone. Representative Matt Grossel. I've got District 2A, North Central Minnesota, Clearwater County, Beltrami County, Lake of the Woods County, and part of Hubbard. Good morning.
Representative Herr.
Present as Representative Kali Herr, 64A in St. Paul.
Representative Hollins.
Present, Representative Athena Hollins, representing 66B, which is the northern portion of the city of St. Paul.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Brian Johnson from Cambridge. I serve District 32A, which is mostly by Sani County in northern Chisago. This is my fifth term, and all five terms I've been on judiciary. Looking forward to working with everybody here today.
Representative Liebling.
Good morning, everyone. Tina Liebling, House District 26A, which is part of Rochester, which you can see in my virtual background there. Good morning.
Representative Long.
Present. Good morning. Jamie Long, representing Southwest Minneapolis.
Representative Mortensen.
Present. I represent District 55A, Shakopee, Louisville Township, and Jackson Township.
Representative Novotny.
Paul Novotny, 30A, Elk River, Big Lake Township, and a portion of Otsego and Wright County.
Representative Farr.
Ryan Farr, 20A. I represent the western side of Le Sueur County and the southern tier of Scott County.
Representative Robbins. Representative Robbins. And it looks like your sound isn't coming through, but I can see her here. All right, let's.
How do I do?
Oh, we hear you now, Representative Robbins.
Oh, hooray! Sorry, my house laptop logged me out this morning, so I'm trying to figure this out on my home laptop, and this is the first time I've done it with the phone headphones, so sorry. But I'm here. I represent Maple Grove, Rogers, and Dayton in 34A. This is my second term and my second term on this committee, and I very much look forward to serving with all of you. Thank you. How do I mute myself? Does anybody know?
Representative Vang.
Morning, I'm Representative Vang. I represent District 40B, that's Brooklyn Center and a little small portion of Brooklyn Park.
And Representative Zhang.
Hello, I'm Representative Chu Zhang, representing House District 53A, Maplewood, Woodbury, Oakdale, and Land. Thank you.
I believe that's everybody. So thank you very much, everyone. And thank you also for our viewers for your patience as we all figure this out at 8:30 in the morning with our first committee hearing of the year. It will be in the rules, but I would ask when folks are speaking or asking questions, if at all possible, if you could turn your video on. It just makes it easier for those watching in at home as well as everybody else to kind of follow on and interact with each other if we're able to have our cameras on while we're speaking. So if you have any questions as we go ahead today, I would have that preference. And so we're going to have a presentation from the judicial branch today. But first, we actually have a bill to move, which for our new folks, this is quite unusual for on the first day of a committee to actually move a bill. But the bill, and it's I am carrying that bill. If we were in person, I would be handing the gavel over to my vice chair, Kelly Moeller, but via Zoom, it's actually a little more efficient to do it this way. So I will move House File 17, which is a marriage application in-person requirement waiver extended. So it would be my motion to move House File 17 to be placed on the general register. And to explain a little bit about this bill, so back in March, the longstanding law has been that a marriage, to receive a marriage license, you have to go in person to get that marriage license. And so this spring, at the beginning of COVID, we passed a law along with some other things allowing people to do things remotely. And so what this bill does is simply extend that that waiver of the requirement that it be in person. It extends it to May 31st. So it's not changing things permanently. It's just extending that waiver so that counties have the option to give marriage licenses in via remotely. And different counties are doing it that different ways. And we do have a couple testifiers today. And so I think they can explain how it's working. We do have support from the Association of Minnesota Counties. I believe they're one of our testifiers today. And happy to answer questions as we go forward, but it's pretty simple. It's hopefully you've actually read the bill, because it's one of those bills that there's really, it's just over a page. So hopefully folks have had a chance to read that. Let's see, just trying to remember if there's anything else. I think, let's see, we'll go to Representative Scott, and then we will go to testifiers.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And, I can reserve some of my comments to the end of the testimony. But just wondered, is this bill going directly to the floor then, or does it have another stop?
Representative Scott, it will go directly to the general register. So no other committee stops. And I should mention that the current iteration of the waiver expires on January 15th. Today is the 12th, and that is the reason for our urgency in passing this on the very first day of committee. And so with that, we will go to testifiers. The first person I have on the list is Barbara Olson, regional manager for the Government Center and Ridgedale Service Centers Division with Hennepin County. So Ms. Olson, hopefully you are with us. Unmute yourself and please go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Olson and I'm a regional manager with Hennepin County with oversight to the Vital Records Unit. We are responsible for the issuance and storage of Hennepin County marriage records. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the COVID relief bill allowed Minnesota counties the flexibility to process marriage license applications with traditional face-to-face appointments, or we could process the applications remotely using technology and/or mail. Traditional face-to-face appointments provides very high-touch service for the applicants, and they walk out of our office with a marriage license in hand and the experience of doing so. However, in these difficult times, we have many applicants that have been physically unable to travel to or come to in-person appointments due to various COVID-19 related restrictions. Although remote processing takes a little longer to process than face-to-face application, it allows us to meet customer demands and eliminate the potential spread of COVID-19. Hennepin County has processed close to 4,500 remote marriage license applications since April. They've been processed in a safe and secure manner. In Hennepin County, all remote marriage license application includes a notarized statement confirming the applicant's information along with their identification. In mid-December, a group of 8 Minnesota counties gathered to review what each county was doing to process marriage license applications. When we finished, the consensus was that each county processes marriage license applications to suit the needs of their residents and for their county. In other words, some counties are appointment only, some counties are appointment and remote processing, while some counties are also remote processing only. We agree with a temporary extension of this bill through the end of May, and we would be interested in exploring a more permanent solution later in the session. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. And given that I think we only have two testifiers on the list today, does anyone have, if anybody has any questions for Ms. Olson, now would be your chance to raise your hand. Doesn't look like, Representative Scott, go ahead.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Olson, I'm just wondering, and maybe the next testifier, this is a question for them. I'm not sure exactly who the next testifier is, but are most counties, what are most counties doing right now? Is it about half and half, in person and remote? Just have counties kind of gone back now that things have opened up a little more than they were back in March and April? Have they gone back to in-person applications? Thank you.
It truly depends on the county and their ability to meet the needs of the customers. There are some counties that are only doing remote processing only in the metro. There are other counties that are doing appointment only. In Hennepin County, we are processing mostly remotely. However, we do have open slots for customers on a emergency basis.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Any follow-up, Representative Scott? Okay. And I'll just remind folks, because it is very early in the year, that we'll talk through the chair. I know it's a little bit awkward when you can't see me on your screen necessarily all the time, but just a reminder that we'll continue to speak through the chair. It looks like Representative Mortensen had a question. I will just remind folks that these would only be questions specifically for Ms. Olson from Hennepin County. We will have time for further discussion after the testifiers. Representative Mortensen, do you still have a question?
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. My question, you alluded to alluded to a longer-term solution, and I'm curious why we wouldn't be entertaining that today, or why she wouldn't be supportive of that today versus what appears to be a 5-month band-aid.
Ms. Olson.
At this time, we're looking to get through the immediate concern with the pandemic. In the long run, we totally support having a permanent solution here. Right now, we are dealing with not only this expiring on Friday, we also have some potential issues with driver's licenses expiring. So we're trying to work through all of those short-term issues right now.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. I will also add, Representative Mortensen, that there is not agreement across the board with different folks on whether it should be extended permanently. And so the idea today is that we need to get this taken care of quickly as we still live during the pandemic. But if the will of the people is that we continue it more permanently, that will be sort of a different discussion. But at least during this pandemic, we're extending it to the end of this to get us through. Hopefully by May 31st, we're in a much better place as far as public safety is concerned.
Sure. And Madam Chair, if you didn't.
Representative Mortensen.
Thank you. Would you indulge me with sharing where is the dissent on this?
And Representative Mortensen, we can get to this more fully after the other testifier if you still have questions after that point. So we'll have more full committee discussion and folks can weigh in at that point. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just wondering, since we might have a little bit of time here, I just wondered if Ms. Olson could give a bit fuller picture of how the process actually works. So one thing I'm kind of thinking about is we in this committee, not too long ago, we passed an age requirement for marriage. And, you know, how is that working in terms of people proving their age or proving other things they have to show when they get a marriage license? I just want to get a little bit better understanding of how you do that all remotely, if you wouldn't mind.
Ms. Olson.
We, because of a law that was passed last fall requiring documentation of age, if the person is in person, we have to see driver's license or something similar to that to document the age of the applicant. When we're doing it remotely, we ask that a copy of their driver's license or the appropriate document be enclosed so, again, we can prove the age. Typically, the entire process begins with a phone call to our office or an email telling us when they are getting married. That's the most critical piece. We need to find out how quickly they need this marriage license. And based upon that, we will either work directly with them or we'll send out documents so that they can have them notarized and they send back to us.
Representative Liebling, any follow-up?
No, that's fine, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Olson.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Olson. With that, we'll move to the next testifier. We have Betty, and I'm sorry, Betty, if I say your last name incorrectly, Camels from Brown County. If you want to go forward and introduce yourself and let us know how to say your name correctly, it would be appreciated.
Hi. Good morning, Madam Chair. Betty Cummels, very close, Brown County, Minnesota recorder. That's situated in New Ulm, South Central Minnesota. I kind of represent the outstate counties. We have processed some remote applications. We haven't had a big demand for them, but we did come up with a system and we require proof of identity with the driver, copies of the driver's license. And we follow up with a phone interview with each applicant and just ask pertinent questions, get some of the private data like the social security number. And it's working very well. We are open to the public, so the demand for it hasn't been that great in our county, but I know there are still some outstate counties that have not opened up to the public. And as far as moving forward for a long term, I see benefit in that because we often have couples that are out of state and coming home to get married. And the time frame to get the license isn't always convenient. They're not coming home until the Thursday night or the Friday before the wedding and they need their license. So it would be beneficial for that reason in the long term as well. Any questions?
All right. Thank you, Ms. Cummels. I will also remind folks that the issue before us today is House File 17, which is extending the waiver to May 31st. There were no amendments filed. If somebody wants to bring a bill forward to have a more full discussion, you know, the notice that was put forth for the public was the extension of this waiver. And so I just want to be mindful that folks who may have been interested in extending it or opposed to extending it further than May 31st were not properly noticed of that. So we can certainly have a more full discussion of that at a later date, but right now this is the bill before us. Thank you, Ms. Cummels. Does anyone have any questions specifically for this testifier? Okay, it doesn't look like we've got anybody with their hand up. And I don't have any other testifiers listed, but I will give staff a second to let me know if there is somebody. So in real life, they would lean over and tell me. but I've got to watch a second computer monitor to make sure that things are moving along. So we do not have any more testifiers. And so with that, is there any other discussion as far as the committee is concerned to the bill before us with House File 17? All right. No, Representative Scott, you had mentioned that earlier you may have some closing comments. So I will turn it over to you before I renew my motion.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. No, I support the extension, and I appreciate the timeliness of getting this through so we can help our counties and those that want to get married. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Scott. Thank you to our testifiers. I will renew my motion that House File 17 be recommended to be placed on the general register. And then I will remind folks, because we are actually moving a bill, this will be a roll call vote. And so I will, not seeing any other hands, Anna, if you could go ahead with the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
All right. There being 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
There we have it. So high five to all of you for successfully passing our first bill out of the committee. So the motion passes and House File 17 is recommended to be placed on the general register. And now you all will know all about it when it comes before us on the floor. I realized as we moved ahead, I was so excited to get that bill passed that I did not give time to let our staff introduce themselves. We are very, very fortunate here on this committee to have many returning staff and really, really great staff on this committee. And so I will start with our nonpartisan staff. I know they love being on camera and talking about themselves, but want to give them a chance to introduce themselves. So starting with the list I have here, I will start with Nathan Hopkins from House Research.
Hi, everyone. My name is Nathan Hopkins. I'm a nonpartisan legislative analyst with House Research. I've been with House Research since 2017 and been staffing civil law ever since I started. I focus particularly on government data practices issues, which you'll be hearing a lot about in this committee, and other general civil law matters. So great to be here. Good working with you all.
All right. Thank you, Nathan. Next, we'll go to Ben Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, this is Ben Johnson, also with House Research. I have also been staffing the committee since 2017 or been staffing other committees. I staff this committee and the Public Safety Committee. For this committee, I primarily follow the judiciary budget and significant changes to judicial policy, but you'll find we all dabble in various areas.
All right, thank you, Ben. Mary Mullen is the other House researcher. She was unable to be with us this morning, but I do not want to forget her, and we'll have her introduce herself at a later meeting. Next, John Walls from House Fiscal.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is John Walls. I'm with the House Fiscal staff. I've been with the House for over 20 years, but served this committee for about the last 7.
All right, thank you, John. I think that's all of our nonpartisan staff, so now we'll move to partisan staff. Usually we would be able to sort of mingle before and after committee and get to know each other a little bit, but this will have to do for now. So I will go to Callie Lehman.
Hi, good morning. I'm Callie Lehman, and I'm the GOP researcher for this committee.
Thank you, Callie. Looking forward to working with all of you. Next, Rachel Ganani.
Hi, I'm Rachel Ganani. I am the committee administrator for the committee. It's my second biennium here, so I'm such a pro. But my former experience as a practicing attorney for several years, and this is a career shift for me. So I understand it's a steep learning curve, and I'm here to help. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out, and looking forward to working with all of you.
Rachel's a little modest. She's very good, and we're very lucky to have a returning CA on this committee. If you don't have her email saved yet, members, she's the go-to for any questions about the committee, scheduling, all that kind of stuff. Next, we'll go to Anna Borgerding.
Hey, my name's Anna. This is my second session. Both sessions spent working for Chair Beckerfin and Representative Moeller, so I'm lucky in that, and my first session as a committee legislative assistant, so very exciting.
And she, I think she did a great job at saying all of our names correctly. We're lucky we didn't throw anything too difficult at her.
I'm not sure if you said my name. You blacked out for me. My name is Ellen McDaniel. I'm the DFL researcher for this committee. This is my second.
All right. So thank you, everybody. Like as I mentioned, we're very lucky to have very good staff on this committee. Please do reach out if you have questions. They are all here to help. I don't think I forgot anybody. So we'll get to Mary Mullen at a later date. And with that, we will move on to our judicial branch overview. So we have State Court Administrator Jeff Shorba to introduce us to the judicial branch. So I want to welcome you to the committee and ask that you introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony, Mr. Shorba. Mr. Shorba, I believe you're muted. There you go.
My first technical difficulty. The next will come when I'm going to try to share my screen here. Good morning, everyone. I'm happy to be here for your first meeting and to present to the committee. I'm going to look for the presentation here to share the screen with you in a second here.
Thanks for your patience as we get this figured out.
It came up very well in rehearsals.
Very good. Well, we've got it in front of us now. Go ahead, Mr. Shorba.
Thank you. So Chair Beckerfin, Vice Chair Representative Moeller, Minority Lead Representative Scott, and committee members. My name is Jeff Shorba, and I am the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. And before I begin my presentation, I really want to thank all of you for your interest in learning more about the judicial branch, and also to hear a little bit about our response to the pandemic. You've already talked a little bit about pandemic this morning, but we wanted to make sure you understand what the court system is doing and has been doing over the last 9 months. I also want to take this opportunity to relay a message from Chief Justice Gilday. She looks forward to working with all of you during the 2021 session, and she'll be setting up meetings with all of you to discuss issues of mutual concern, and of course the branch's budget request as we get to that part of the session. So first of all, I want to start with an overview of the judicial branch and talk a little bit about what we've been doing in response to the pandemic. Andy, the slides aren't moving. So really, those are the two main areas for my focus this morning. Here we go. So the first is just to give you a reminder about the judicial branch mission. We're providing justice, we hope, through a system that really assures equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies. This has been our mission statement for a number of years, and we take it very seriously. There are very important words in here, and we'll try to focus on some of these words as we give you an overview of the branch. But obviously, equal access for everyone, timeliness, especially during this time of the pandemic, is a concern for us, and we'll talk a little bit more about how we're doing with that. as we get into the presentation. This is just a reminder that the court system is a core government function addressed in Article 1 of the Minnesota Constitution, guaranteeing everyone a remedy through the court system, obtaining justice freely without purchase, promptly, of course, again, without delay. Every Minnesota is entitled under the Constitution to a remedy in both criminal and civil cases. For those of you not familiar with the judicial branch, as the third branch of government, we aren't the largest part of state government, but we have about 321 judges. Those are allocated by the legislature, approximately 2,600 employees. We handle about 1.2 million cases a year. That includes everything from traffic citations to first degree murder. Geographically, we are the most diverse part of state government, covering more geographic areas than any other part of government with 105 locations across the state. The legislature provides about $735 million of general fund money each biennium for us to operate the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, all of our district courts, our judges' salaries, the state law library, and the state court administrator's office. As you see from the asterisks, this does not include civil legal services budget. We operate as a pass-through from the legislature for the civil legal services budget, which is about almost $30 million over the biennium. And I'm sure you'll be hearing separately from civil legal services about their operations. We have a streamlined, what is called a form of operations for the judicial branch here in Minnesota. Three-tier structure, two appellate courts, and a single trial court called the district court. This is not true in every state. You go to some of our neighbors, they may have a trial court, but they may have separate justice of the peace courts or juvenile courts. Ours are all unified into one trial court bench, and that unification took place in 1987. The Court of Appeals was established by constitutional amendment in 1983 to handle the large number of appeals from the trial courts. The Supreme Court has seven members who hear cases and decide cases as a group. The Court of Appeals has 19 members, and they hear cases in three-judge panels. And then there are 295 members, obviously, in our largest court, the district court. So I want to just touch briefly on each of these levels of court to just give you a little bit more information. The seven-member Supreme Court hears direct appeals, which we call petitions for further review, from the Court of Appeals, the Tax Court, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and first-degree murder convictions. Some of those go directly to the Supreme Court. The Tax Court, Workers' Comp, Court of Appeals, first-degree murder convictions go directly to the Supreme Court. And then the court has what we call original jurisdiction in legislative election contests and judicial and attorney discipline cases. Only the Supreme Court can discipline judges and attorneys. Just to give you some idea about the number of petitions we get at the Supreme Court level and how many are actually taken, in 2019, we had 620 petitions for further review filed with the court, 95 direct appeals. Of those 620 petitions for review, 87% were denied, so only 13% were accepted for some kind of hearing with the Supreme Court. So a lot more petitions for review than are actually taken by the court and heard by the court. And those are all assessed by the court, each individual case, and decided whether they should be taken. The Court of Appeals hears appeals from trial court decisions, administrative agency decisions, the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So these are unemployment compensation claims. And they have original jurisdiction to hear what we call either writs of mandamus or prohibition. And those are situations where they may be asking the court to compel a trial court, a corporation, a public authority to do something or forbid them from doing something. So those cases also go to the Court of Appeals first and then may be appealed up to the Supreme Court. And again, those 19 judges hear cases in three-judge panels. The district court is obviously our largest court with 295 judges. They hear cases on all of these various case types. All judges are authorized to hear cases in all of these case types, but in some of our largest jurisdictions, we may have divisions, a civil division, a juvenile division, a family division, where judges may specialize a little bit more due to efficiency purposes in those larger jurisdictions. And then right now, the jurisdiction level for our conciliation court division are civil disputes who go up to $15,000. And those, again, are either heard by trial court judges or in our largest jurisdictions, they may be heard by specialized judges or referees handling those particular kinds of cases. The filings that we have at the trial court level break down into what we call major and minor cases. In terms of workload, it's important to note that judges spend about 85% of their time on the major case types. So even though we have a much larger group of minor cases, it's the major cases that take the most judge time, and those would include criminal felonies and gross misdemeanors, dissolution cases in the family area, domestic abuse, transfer of legal custody. In the civil area are bigger cases like contracts, personal injury, malpractice, employment, harassment. And then in the juvenile area, termination of parental rights, delinquency, children in need of protection cases. So those are the ones that really take the most judge time. And actually, those are the ones that we actually see, as we'll talk a little bit more in our budget hearing, those are the ones we see actually going up a little bit more than the minor cases right now. From an organizational perspective, the court system is divided into 10 judicial districts for two purposes, administrative purposes and election purposes. So as you can see from the map, we have two single county districts, the 4th District, Hennepin County, and the 2nd District in Ramsey. The other eight are multi-county districts, ranging from four counties up in the 6th District to our largest district geographically, the 9th District, with 17 counties. And as you can see, those district in the ninth, you know, takes up about a fourth of the state, so a large geographic area. So judges running in these districts, you may be a judge sitting there in Brainerd and Crow Wing County, and you'll be elected by constituents all the way up to Kitson County, so a very large area. But in the fourth, you'd have a lot more people that are going to be voting in that particular election. Those 10 judicial districts are established by state statute, and they were last established in 1959, was the last time that statute was changed. Our administrative structure, by statute, the Chief Justice is the administrative head of the judicial branch and responsible for its overall management. As you may know, some of you have been on our committees for a while. In 2005, we established what we call the Judicial Council, which is our single administrative policymaking body for the judicial branch, and I'll talk a little bit more about its structure in a minute. My office, the State Court Administrator's Office, serves as staff to the Judicial Council, and we provide assistance in all kinds of areas, HR, finance, information technology, et cetera, to the branch as a whole, and information to the Judicial Council. The Chief Justice, as you see in the lower left-hand corner, leads the Supreme Court, which continues to have responsibility for regulating the practice of law, determining who is admitted to the bar here in the state of Minnesota. They oversee all of our rules committees. They oversee any of our boards that are related to the practice of law, and those include lawyers' professional responsibility, regulating lawyer behavior, our boards dealing with continuing legal education and admission to the bar. Then as you see from the middle box, there is a chief judge of each of the courts. The Court of Appeals has a chief judge appointed by the governor. Each district court has a chief judge appointed by their peers. And then they determine who's going to be the district administrator for each of our districts, as well as there is a county court administrator overseeing county operations in each of our county courts. These are the primary responsibilities for our judicial council. As I mentioned, setting statewide policies, strategic planning. We have a 2-year strategic plan. We're working on our plan for the next biennium right now. They determine what our legislative agenda is going to be, if we're going to ask for any changes in statute as we go into each legislative session. Very importantly, they determine what we're going to ask you as the legislature to allocate to the branch for the next biennium in terms of our budget. And we'll be coming back from you hopefully to talk in more detail about our current request to the legislature and the governor for the next biennium. And then court performance and accountability. We take very importantly our need to monitor ourselves. How are we doing in a whole range of indicators? How long our cases are taking? How quickly do we get to resolution, et cetera? And those are all published in our strategic plan and our annual report to the legislature and on our website. Over the past 10 months, I do have to say that our judicial council has really been instrumental on advising the Chief Justice on the branch's response to the pandemic and guiding our implementation and directives on orders issued by the Chief Justice with regard to our pandemic response. So I want to turn briefly, and we can take questions whenever you would like, Madam Chair, but turn briefly to talk a little bit about our pandemic response so that you understand what we've been doing in the judicial branch over the last 9 months, along with all other parts of state government.
Mr. Shorba, I think before we move on to the pandemic response, I just want to let folks know that we will have a more budget-specific presentation. The idea today is that you understand the structure and scope of the judicial branch. So if there are any questions from members as to the structure and scope and what has been gone over so far, we can take a couple questions before we get to the pandemic response. It looks like Vice Chair Moeller has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks also to Mr. Shorba. And perhaps this question is for the later presentation, as you mentioned, Chair Becker-Finn, but I was just curious how interpretive services are funded. If those, I know there's kind of a mix of state employees versus not, and I'd just be curious to get a little more information about that.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Moeller, thank you for your question. All interpreter services are paid for out of general fund appropriations. We do have some staff interpreters who are situated in various districts or around the state. We have them broken down by language. So we have some Spanish interpreters, which is the largest group of staff interpreters. We have a Somali interpreter. We have Hmong interpreter. So we have about, I think it's 6 or 7 staff interpreters dispersed throughout the branch. And then the rest of the interpreters are ones that we use based on their position on our roster. So we have basically 3 levels of interpreters. One are those who are certified in their language, means they have passed a national exam to become certified in their language, and they get priority in terms of recruitment to handle interpreter events across the state. The other are those who are what we call rostered. They have taken a test and passed an English proficiency exam, and they are the ones who sit on our roster and are there for our court administrators to look to if we can't get a certified interpreter. And then the last, if we have to go to, is non-rostered interpreters. And those may be ones where we have a very unique language where we don't possibly have anyone in the state who speaks that language, and we have to go somewhere else and either have a Zoom call with them or some kind of a phone call with them to handle very unique languages. We We have about 105 languages every year that appear within our courts, some very unique, some much more common, of course, with Spanish. So that's a little bit of a summary of how we deal with interpreters. If that answers your question, Representative Mueller.
Any follow-up, Representative Mueller? All right. Doesn't look like we have any other questions yet. So Mr. Shorba, if you can go ahead now with the pandemic response.
Certainly. So as I mentioned, as you know, because you've been dealing with it as well, this has been a really long and difficult year for our justice system. It's really challenged our ability to fulfill our constitutional responsibility to provide, as we said in the Constitution, justice freely, promptly, and without delay. And it's really forced us to take some unprecedented steps to protect the health and safety of court users, our justice partners, our judges, and our staff. So we've asked a lot of the state's court users and attorneys. We've asked for their patience as we've had to limit physical access to our courthouses, as we've had to postpone hearings and trials. We've asked them to adapt to new safety protocols in our courthouses and courtrooms. We've also, like all of you, asked them to adjust to new technology, Zoom and Skype and online courtrooms. But I think through all of this, we've really persevered, and I want to take this opportunity just to thank, on behalf of the branch, all those court users, partners, and the legal community really for their patience and adaptability over these past 10 months. Our focus has always been on determining how we can provide access to justice in a manner that prioritizes the health and safety of our court users and our judges and staff. So in March and April, in the early days of the pandemic, we limited most in-person activity in our state's court facilities. This included a moratorium on most criminal and civil trials. But understanding that we were going to be going through this, you know, at first we didn't know how long it would be, and then we understood this is not a short-term event. And so we spent those 2 months trying to figure out how we could eventually resume in-person hearings and trials safely. So we worked very closely with the Minnesota Department of Health, developed new health and safety protocols for our courthouses, you know, along with a step-by-step guide for how courts could resume holding jury trials. Along with that, our IT staff worked day and night to try to transition judges quickly to remote operations with equipment and other procedures that we had to put in place. When we got to June, we decided that the best approach for criminal jury trials was to try some pilots, see how this was going to work out, because we knew there was a lot of apprehension, not only among our own judges and staff, but among the public. So we are one of the first states in the country to resume criminal jury trials, and the safety protocols we developed with the Minnesota Department of Health have actually been borrowed and adapted by states across the country as they began opening up. So we had 6 pilot counties who held pilot trials. They included Blue Earth, Hennepin, McLeod, Olmsted, Ramsey, and Scott counties. Stringent safety protocols were put in place, masks were mandated, jurors were seated throughout the courtroom to ensure social distancing was maintained. Other courtrooms had to be used not only for public viewing, but for jurors to deliberate. As you can probably imagine, not every courtroom was able to accommodate this, so we had to move some jury trials to either other courthouses or other locations to try to accommodate those strict safety protocols. Once July came, we began expansion of criminal jury trials more broadly across the state. But before each county could hold a criminal jury trial, they had to develop a detailed plan showing how it would comply with our new safety and health guidelines. Each plan was reviewed by a team of judges and staff experts. And by early September, criminal jury trials had resumed in all 87 counties. And I'll talk a little bit about what we've learned from those pilots and the jury trial experience a couple slides from now. With civil trials, we took a little bit more measured approach. We had originally set a moratorium on civil jury trials through September 1st, but in late August, in order to deal with the criminal backlog, we decided to extend that moratorium until December 1st. However, there had been a number of jury trials that were already scheduled to begin in September, and we decided to allow those to continue so we'd have a little bit of experience with civil trials as long as they were able to meet the same safety and health protocols that we had set aside for criminal trials. So while we were proud of everything we accomplished by resuming in-person proceedings and criminal trials, as the fall proceeded, we, like you, saw some of our numbers ticking up. And we were in constant contact with the Department of Health, getting their guidance. And as we saw infection rates increase through November, just like the governor took some action, the Judicial Council met in November, to see how the council should react. And what happened is on November 20th, the Chief Justice issued a new statewide order that once again suspended most in-person court proceedings, including both criminal and civil trials, through the end of January of 2021. Trials that were already underway were allowed to finish, and we also created an exception process for in-person hearings under exceptional circumstances. So where there was a speedy trial demand and the person was being held in custody, they could try to seek an exception to hold an in-person either hearing or trial. But generally, our goal was to continue to hold things remotely. In addition, we allowed public service counters to remain accessible either through remote fashion, if they could do it safely, live in a courthouse, or by appointments. So we wanted to make sure that our public service counters were able to serve the public in some way through this two-month period under the chief's order. I will tell you the council will be meeting again this Thursday, 2 days from now, to discuss what's going to happen next. The order exists through January 31st, and they will be advising the Chief Justice as to whether or not we make some adjustments to that particular order as we move through the spring. And we'll be also talking about what we learned from statistics from the Department of Health.
And Mr. Shorba, Representative Scott has a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Representative Shorba, I'm assuming you're going to get to this eventually, so I'll ask this question first, but I'm assuming you're going to get to what kind of backlog you're experiencing. And then one of the questions I have immediately for kind of the slide that we were just on, civil trials, you know, I work a lot in family law policy, and in situations where there's a trial for custody, are these families just kind of in limbo for extended periods of time as far as that goes? Or how are those cases in particular working right now? And then I have a question after that as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we will be covering the backlog in a minute, so I'll hold off on the answer to that question for a second here. As far as the civil cases go, we're lucky that many of those can be handled remotely, especially in the family law area. So we'll talk a little bit about what we're seeing in terms of backlog in various areas. The biggest backlog, of course, is in criminal. Actually, in family law, we've been able pretty well to keep up because most of those have been done remotely. And so we're doing actually pretty well with those. So those have not been just sitting. Families have been able to have their cases heard remotely. And actually, we'll talk a little bit about this in a minute too. We're hearing pretty positive things from people about being able to do these things remotely.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this may be premature as well, but I'm wondering in all of this COVID funding that came down from the feds, if there was any funding for the courts to get things safe for people to actually have their rights practiced in the courts.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, yes, we did receive CARES Act funding to deal with a couple of various things. One is initially we received funding to deal with personal protective equipment that we either provided for our staff or judges, or we provided for those coming into the courtroom. We received some funding to use for what we call senior judges to help with the backlog. That was going pretty well until the November order came out. That funding has not been extended by MMB past the 1st of January, so that funding will have to go away. And then we received some funding to beef up our remote hearing technologies to allow our staff and judges to handle things remotely, as well as to put some things within our courtrooms to deal with remote technology as well. So those were the three basic categories where we received CARES Act funding. Thank you for that question.
Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
I'm good. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Shorba.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Shorba, with the rest of the presentation.
So this slide talks a little bit about our jury trial experience. Between June and November, our district courts held a total of 184 criminal jury trials and 10 civil jury trials. Now that's about one third of the number of trials we held during the same period in 2019. Just to give you some idea, among the 184 criminal jury trials, 89% reached a verdict. And among the civil jury trials, 90% reached a verdict. So they were able to proceed with the health and safety protocols in place. It's important to know that Minnesota does not allow anyone to decline to serve on a jury. They can be excused from service on a jury. But at the same time, we didn't see a big increase in the number of requests for postponements of the jury trial. As you can see from the figure on the middle of this slide, it was about the same as in 2019. And actually, our failure to report rate actually decreased during the pandemic. So we had more people reporting for jury trial service than we did pre-pandemic. So that was encouraging people, I think, from what we've heard, and we've surveyed jurors after the trials, felt like the procedures we put in place for health and safety were positive, and they felt safe serving on a jury. So that was very encouraging among our surveys. Just to give you an idea of technology, we've relied heavily on the use of remote technology, not only for internal meetings, but for conducting hearings. At present, over 90% of all court hearings are being held remotely. We've also done things to accommodate those who don't have the capability to participate in remote hearings. Maybe they don't have their own technology, their own computers. So we have set up in our courthouses technology rooms where we have either computers or iPads or something where somebody can come in and use our technology in a safe manner to conduct their hearings and appear before their hearings. We're also rolling out a new pilot project where we are specifically providing technical assistance to those who may be in their home, but they get confused, just like I do, about how to use Zoom and, you know, what I should be doing, and yes, I'm on mute. And so technical assistance directly to those who are sitting somewhere other than in our courthouses. And that's proved very popular as we continue to use remote hearings. This just gives you a little idea of the incredible work we've undertaken to maintain court operations during this time of crisis. As you can see, in mid-July, our district courts held a little more than 16,000 hearings per week. About 60% of those were held with remote hearing technology. You know, for reference, pre-pandemic, our district courts were holding more than 26,000 hearings per week, so about 10,000 less per week than we had pre-pandemic, but that was sort of at the beginning as we were just beginning to open up. So for the week ending December 18th, our district courts held more than 24,000 hearings a week, which is more than 90% of our pre-pandemic normal. Since our courts suspended most in-person court activity at the end of November, more than 90%, as I mentioned, of all hearings have been conducted remotely. So we, even in this remote environment, are doing pretty well in terms of keeping up with what's going on. As I'll mention on the next slides, that isn't necessarily true if we're not able to hold trials. So I wanted to just talk briefly about felony and gross misdemeanors. The use of remote technology has helped in some situations. So in civil and family, our caseloads have increased briefly about 6%, from 40,000 to 42,000. So not a huge increase. We really have no backlog right now for juvenile delinquency, children in need of protection cases or permanency cases. But unfortunately, as you can see on this chart, the same cannot be said for felony and gross misdemeanor cases. At the present, the backlog is up 33% from the beginning of the pandemic. We're concentrating on tackling this backlog, as I mentioned, through the use of both active and senior judges. The Judicial Council actually set a goal to reduce the backlog by 10%, and we were on track to do that through the use of active and senior judges until the November in-person restrictions were put in place. So we're trying as best we can to handle things remotely, but until we can get back to more of a trial schedule, not only holding trials, but as those of you who work in the legal field know, scheduling a trial and the threat of a trial gets parties to settle a case. And without trials being set and the threat of that, we're having problems dealing with this particular backlog. So it's our most concerning area now within the district court system. Some of you may have questions about evictions. It's been an area where we've received many inquiries and discussions between our partners. As you can see, the number of eviction cases that have been filed really has plummeted due to the state moratorium. So during the time that the governor's executive order has been in place and the corresponding chief justice order, all 10 judicial districts have issued orders directing that all evictions filed are to be reviewed by a judge, and those eviction filings that do not meet one of the exceptions, so public safety exception, a legal activity exception, are to be made confidential during the moratorium. We don't want the fact that an eviction case has been filed against somebody, it can't be processed because it doesn't meet an exception used against an individual, so those cases are now kept confidential until we can deal with them in some manner after the moratorium is lifted. We are trying to put procedures in place, not knowing when the moratorium is going to be lifted and what the huge number, if it's going to be a huge number, sitting there will be. We are working with leadership in each district to develop protocols for case processing. We're reviewing things that we have on our website, FAQs and scripts for court staff to use in assisting landlords and tenants. We've been working very closely with legal services providers to make sure that we are referring people to places where they can get help, even during the moratorium, but certainly if something comes about after the moratorium. And we've been working with the State Bar Association on sort of a pro bono campaign, which we're launching later this month, called Lawyers Step Up for Minnesota, to try to provide pro bono services should the moratorium be lifted. So it's an area we're working on, but it's a little bit of an unknown given that the numbers are something we're just guessing at as soon as the moratorium is lifted.
And Mr. Shorba, Representative Robbins has a question. Great. Go ahead, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Shorba. Looking at the backlog, referring back to the slide on felony and gross misdemeanors, you mentioned that it had been going fairly well using senior judges, but that funding is about to expire. And so clearly, this is a priority for all of us. So is there any CARES money that you could use for continuing the senior judges reviewing these cases, or is there something in the very short term that the legislature could do to address this so that we don't have a lag in the use of senior judges?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins. CARES funding has expired. You may be aware that Minnesota Management and Budget made some decisions about which entities will be extended time to spend their CARES money and which will not. I will say we weren't consulted on that decision. We were just told that our senior judge funding would expire and would not be extended. And we were disappointed with that decision by MMB. We have some funding that is in our base budget for senior judges, but it's not as much as we had gotten from the CARES Act. I don't know if there'll be additional CARES applications that we can use, but right now we have no more CARES funding that we can use for senior judges. So we could certainly talk whether there might be some short term once sort of this order is lifted and we can begin doing more of these to supplement some of our senior judge funding, but in direct answer to your question, no, we can't use any CARES money on this anymore. And we may need to ask for some supplemental given what we see coming in terms of this backlog.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, Mr. Shorba, but you cut out a little bit to my ears when you were speaking. So was it the Minnesota Management and Budget or the Federal Office of Management and Budget? Which entity decided that additional money was not going to be extended to you?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, it was Minnesota Management and Budget that made those decisions.
Thank you.
Any more follow-up, Representative Robbins?
Not at this time, thank you.
Great. Thank you. And then Representative Vang has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shorba, I just have a quick question about the eviction. Can you clarify again what you mean by confidential if people were to file for eviction, but however doesn't meet the eviction moratorium exceptions? What do you mean by it's just kept confidential, and what's the protocol after that if the eviction moratorium is lifted?
Mr. Shorba.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Vang, those are classifications for our cases within our case management system. So a case may be classified as public, which means it would be available and viewable by the public on one of our terminals or for those justice partners who have access to our case management system. If it's confidential, it means that it can't be seen on a public terminal. So what we're trying to do here is we understand an eviction case may be filed against an individual. It doesn't meet one of the exceptions, public safety, illegal activity on the premises, et cetera. So then we would classify in our case management system that case as confidential. If the moratorium is lifted, it'd be up then for the landlord or who's ever filed the eviction proceeding to determine whether they want to continue proceeding with the case. We would then contact them. If they want to continue, then it would probably then become a public case because it depends, you know, we don't know what the order is going to say. So if it's going to create broader exceptions, if it's going to say everything can go forward, it really will depend on what the governor's order and then the chief justice's order says. But right now, confidential means it's not viewable to the public. You can't be.
Any follow-up, Representative Vang?
I might have more questions. I'm just trying to word how this question is going to be. Those cases that has been filed. So if there were no eviction moratorium, then what I understand right now with the eviction moratorium, they're not able to do that. And so actually, sorry, Madam Chair, just come back to me. I'm still trying to word this question.
Yep, no problem, Representative Vang. And now Representative Mortensen has a question. Go ahead, Representative Mortensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The simple business person in me is analyzing this chart in front of us and looking at, I'll get to my question here. I mean, we had a booming economy all of 2019. It looks like we averaged 1,400 evictions a month while at we had that economy. Now the moratorium has kicked in and we see essentially that it disappeared. My question is, has there been any sort of demand planning done as to what these numbers will look like when the moratorium is lifted and considering the state of our economy?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Mortensen, we are, through our research and development group and talking with landlords and tenants and others across the state, we're trying to have a best guess. As you mentioned, there's a lot of variables that are changing. We can't say it's going to be 1,500 because maybe the economy's not the same. People are out of work. People aren't able to pay their rent. So could that number be a lot higher than 1,500? But I guess all I can tell you right now, because that's one variable, the other variable is how will it be lifted? Will there be further restrictions? Will it be totally lifted? Ours is sort of a best guess as to what the numbers will be, and we're probably not going to know for sure until we actually get the information we need to see what's happening with changes to the moratorium. So we are trying our best, working with Justice Partners on this, but it is a guess right now because of those variables. Thank you for the
follow-up, Representative Mortensen.
I would just say that I would have to imagine it would be much higher than that 1,500, but I'm curious to see how that would look, because I think there's going to be significant implications across the housing sector as a whole based on what happens, because obviously the other side of the story here is the landlords themselves and their position.
Thank you. And I know in talking to housing advocates and others that there is a lot of concern here. I know some folks have referred to this as the eviction tsunami that they see on the horizon. And so I'm sure this will not be, I can promise you this won't be the only time we talk about this issue, because it is certainly something we're going to have to face moving forward. So thank you for your questions, members. Mr. Shorba, we'll let you finish up your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to touch briefly on the appellate courts. The Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals have really been able to maintain their caseload and hearing schedule through remote technology innovations and really don't have a backlog of pending cases. It should be noted that obviously there are less obstacles due to no witnesses, no juries in the appellate courts, but still a success because both courts have adapted to using technology and still having cases available and open to the public. So that's been very positive. Just so you know, the bar exam was successfully conducted in July and September in person with safety protocols in place. So we're very proud of that. And new attorneys continue to be sworn in. Our clerk of appellate courts recently conducted a couple of curbside swearing in, so we're trying as much as we can to accommodate those new attorneys who continue to pass the bar and want to be sworn in Minnesota. So lastly, I just want to talk a little bit about how we see ourselves moving forward. We want to expand on lessons learned and continue to provide court services in a manner that is focused on our court users' convenience and access. First and foremost, we are going to continue relying on public health guidance from the Department of Health and the CDC. This pandemic has made it clear that the importance of the remote hearing and online services our courts already offer, but also the appetite that attorneys and the public have for doing more of their business with the courts online. So there are a number of questions. Are we going to transition when this is over to business as usual? We've formed a working group to look at that question and advise the Judicial Council on what kinds of practices we may be able to continue even after the pandemic is over. We're exploring expansion of online services. We've done that already during the pandemic, but we think we can do even more. We are seeing from not only litigants, self-represented individuals, our justice partners, there's a lot of positives that have come out of this pandemic. Before, you may have shown up at a courthouse and waited around to have your case called, and that wait could be an hour, 2 hours. Now, in our Zoom environment, you may have a 9:30 Zoom call scheduled because you need to be scheduled for a call. You can't just wait around in a lobby somewhere. And our individuals who interact with our court system feel very positive about that. They like having a defined time. They also like the fact that instead of taking half a day off from their work and coming and sitting around the courthouse, they can take a 30-minute break from their job and get on a Zoom call and have their case resolved. So there are things like that that we are going to continue working with our justice partners on. We are initiating both a self-help center survey of litigants as well as an attorney survey, which is being distributed to both groups to try to find out what information we can gain from the remote environment. And we should have those results sometime in late February. So I think we've accomplished a lot. Our technology advancements have been amazing. We always know, however, that we have more work to do. One of the things we pride ourselves on is being a very innovative court system, ever-changing and adapting, which we've had to do more this year than ever before. So I want to conclude my remarks just by once again thanking court users, justice partners, and the legal community for their patience and adaptability. And I also want to thank our judges and staff who have worked tirelessly in very fluid environments to try to make sure that we are providing service to those who are using our court system across the state of Minnesota. So I look forward to any of your additional questions and to meeting you all virtually, maybe in person, and talking more about the court system with you throughout this legislative session. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Shorba. I will note that we don't have the latitude to go over time because of the constraints with the live streaming. So we've got 8 minutes here, but we'll go to Vice Chair Moeller with a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment and a question. My comment is I just want to thank you as someone who regularly practices in appellate courts when I'm not at the Capitol. I do really appreciate all the efforts that have gone in to adapt during COVID-19. And another comment is just whatever we can do to be supportive as you're dealing with this backlog of cases, because for a speedy trial violation, the remedy is dismissal of the case. So we want to make sure that we're both making sure people get their speedy trial, but also not resulting in that remedy. My question has to do with orders for protection and harassment restraining orders, and I'm wondering if you've seen any change in the number of those types of orders issued.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, I don't believe we've seen a significant increase. I think we've had a slight increase. Some of that may be attributed just the position here to more people spending more time together at home and, you know, all the stress that goes with that. But I don't think it's been a significant increase, but I could get an actual number for you on that and email your office with that information.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Shorba. And if you could send that to the committee administrator, we could share that with the rest of the committee members as well. Yep. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shorba, I guess I wanted to kind of make a little bit of a comment about, you know, what happens after COVID-19. You know, I think we've all found in the private and public sectors that sometimes it's easier to do the remote stuff because of the technologies today. But I'm really torn, and I guess it's not an all or nothing thing. Less serious cases could possibly be done remotely, but I think there's so much value to in-person appearances in many cases. And I'm thinking particularly of maybe first-time offenders and having the sort of the nerve-wracking feelings that go along with appearing for the first time, and how that would probably cut down on recidivism a little bit, just because it's such a serious matter. And I think so I just hope that will be taken into consideration, and as these decisions are made going forward. I think that the other side of that, of course, is that there's a lot of money that can be saved by doing these remote hearings, but I don't want to I don't want justice to be sacrificed for dollars. So I think it's going to be a careful balance of how we go forward. Thank you. No, you can respond if you want, but I just wanted to kind of get that out there as a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Shorba, for a really good presentation.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Scott. And I think just so to make sure we have time, I know Representative Johnson has a question as well. So Representative Johnson.
Chair, Mr. Shorba, members, I have to agree with Representative Scott on this. I've been in the courtroom many times as a testifier, as security, also involved in investigations, talking to the people. There is nothing better than in-person, one-on-one, or being actually there when the testimony is being done. Because it's not just the words the people say, it's also their reactions, their body language. It makes so much difference. When a jury sees somebody squirming because they aren't telling the absolute truth in the witness chair, they notice that. It affects them. Because it's the system, our system is designed to get the truth. And if you can hide behind a screen, you can say whatever you want, and a lot of people won't see your body language, which is, I don't know if you've noticed, because we're wearing masks so much in public, people are having a hard time understanding what people are saying, not because the mask is muffling the voice, because people are now seeing how much they actually read lips instead of listen to the words. And we have to make sure that we're actually reading the body language when we're doing these court tests, court trials, because that is so important. And I have to agree with Representative Scott as well. We can't sacrifice justice just to save a little money.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And I think absolutely, I know, you know, some of the more sort of, you know, technical types of hearings where we're not necessarily, you know, judge, you know, not a jury trial, certainly, but I do think there is space into what you spoke to, you know, to have a person miss a half day of work so that they can have a 5-minute hearing doesn't make a lot of sense. It never made a lot of sense to me. And so I think there are sometimes we're certainly hopefully some of the investments that were made in technology and those processes can be helpful to us moving forward. And with that, it is 9:58. We are going to end on time. So that will conclude our hearing for today. That presentation was emailed to members and is posted on our committee website. Our next hearing will take place this Thursday, again, starting at 8:30 a.m., and we'll be hearing from the public defenders as well as civil legal aid. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.